Here's a look at our headlines this hour. President Biden and President Yoon pledge to expand the scope and the scale of U.S.-South Korea military exercises to ramp up deterrence against the North. Russia cuts off gas flow to Finland over its refusal to pay for supplies in rubles. And Bahraini opposition groups react as the Saudi Supreme Court upholds death sentences against two Bahraini men. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. U.S. and South Korean presidents have vowed to expand the scope and scale of military exercises by their countries to ramp up deterrence against the North. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol and his U.S. counterpart Joe Biden met in Seoul earlier on Saturday. Biden said the 70-year alliance between Washington and Seoul was built on working together to deter Pyongyang. Biden is in South Korea on the first leg of his Asian tour that will also take him to Japan. His trip to Seoul met with protests on Friday and Saturday, with protesters voicing anger at the military cooperation between their country and the U.S. They argued that the cooperation would provoke an arms race. They also say Washington's aggressive military strategy will escalate tensions in the region. Our correspondent Jennifer Chang in Seoul tells us more as to why some groups there are opposed to the alliance between South Korea and the U.S.
They are polarized. One group consists of older South Koreans who favor the U.S.-South Korea alliance. The other part of the protesters consists of younger South Koreans who want the alliance to be over. They say it endangers peace on the Korean Peninsula and increases the chance of war, saying that President Biden's visit to South Korea is not good for the South. The President of America is meeting the newly elected President of South Korea, Yoon Suk-yeol, and is going to be stressing the power of the South Korea-U.S. military and economic alliance. A total of 10,600 or so protesters are out on the street, and the anti-U.S. protests are all over the place, scattered all over. President Biden is staying at the Grand Hyatt Seoul Hotel. There has been an anti-U.S. protest and picketing there. There has been an additional protest here at the Defense Ministry where the South Korean president, who's been newly elected Yoon Suk-yeol, will be working from.
Russia has just cut a flow of natural gas to Finland after it refused to pay for future supplies in the Russian national currency. Finland's energy firm says, though regrettable, the halt will cause no disruptions in the gas transmission network. Gazprom says it's been carefully preparing for this situation last Saturday. Russia also cut electricity deliveries to Finland over payment issues. The developments come as Finland and Sweden are planning to join NATO. The two submitted their bids on Wednesday. Russia is opposed to their move, citing security threats caused by NATO expansion. Moscow has promised retaliation should Finland and Sweden join the Western military alliance. Tim Kirby joins us now. He's a host and political commentator from Moscow. Tim, thank you for making the time. It's good to have you with us. So it seems that Finland is getting a taste of its own medicine. Joining NATO apparently has cost it dearly. Now, do you think this will affect Europe in general as well?
Maybe to an extent about Europe, but the thing I want to say is that we can't forget that overall, despite the fact that technically Finland was neutral during the Cold War, as was, say, Austria, in reality, they've been on the side of the West for a long time. This doesn't really change that much in terms of the structure of NATO. The one thing that is the real threat here is that it allows easier access for Washington to put something closer to Moscow to potentially create the opportunity for a unretaliated first strike war. That's what the Russians are really scared of. They want more distance from NATO. But like I said, with the close relationship between Finland and the United States, who knows what's already there?
You know, Europe is already suffering from high energy prices and the cost of living crisis and all. This can get worse, right?
It absolutely can, especially with words floating around Moscow about trading wheat for rubles. That could change the game as well, because people don't really understand is that over the last, say, what would it be, 20 years about, Russia has created some very big yet quiet successes. One of them was grain. If we remember from the Soviet Union, which was somewhat inept when it came to farming, even right up to the end, the Soviet Union really had to sort of sell oil and gas and whatnot in order to feed itself. That has become the exact opposite. Now Russia is the big exporter of grain, and not just wheat grain, but many other types of grains as well. And also a massive producer of meat. That was another problem. Russians even remark about how they've been starting to export chicken even to the United States, which in the early 90s, many Russians had to survive on what they called bush legs, as in George Bush Sr. legs, these thighs and drumsticks that were sent here as sort of a humanitarian aid.
And finally, Tim, Moscow has also promised retaliation should Finland and Sweden join the Western military alliance. Do you have any expectation or let's say any prediction as to what those retaliatory measures might be?
Well, one thing I don't think is I don't think it will be World War III. I think the one thing is the Kremlin very much understands that if a hot war begins between Russia and the United States, that it will lead to some sort of apocalyptic event, and they're not going to do that. However, I do know that by any economic or other soft power means, if some sort of very high speed, maybe not hypersonic, it's debatable the quality of American hypersonic weapons, but let's just say something that's relatively high speed with nuclear warheads gets deployed to Finland, then the Kremlin is going to do everything it can to put maximum pressure onto Finland and make life there a lot more uncomfortable. But we also can't forget that the West and its entire sort of logic of how it survives is based on providing people a very comfortable life that they don't want to give up. So in some ways, the Kremlin has a bit of an advantage, although it may not seem so on the surface.
Tim, it's a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much for joining us. That was Tim Kirby, radio host and political commentator from Moscow. Australians are heading to the polls in the federal election that will decide the next prime minister. About 17 million people are expected to cast their ballots. They will elect lawmakers for the House of Representatives and just over half of the seats in the Senate. Australia's ruling Liberal National Coalition and Labour Party are main contenders. Each party needs at least 76 of the 151 House seats to form a government. The hung parliament will need them to try to win support from independent MPs or minor parties. Inflation and climate change are the main concerns of the voters. Australia's inflation has surged to 5.1%. That's 2.3% higher than wage growth. The country's cost of living has surged to a 21-year high. British Home Secretary Priti Patel in hot water. She's said to be controlled by a shady group that manages spy agency MI6, inspired research and influence operation. Investigative news website The Grey Zone says leaked emails clearly show the cabal's apparent influence on Patel and her policies. It says the group is being guided in its covert operation in part by former spy chief Richard Dearlove. The Grey Zone says the cabal also sought to seize power over energy policy and displace a government minister. The revelations raise serious questions about Patel's fitness to rule on WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange's extradition to the U.S. Earlier this month, the Grey Zone exposed a plot against former UK Prime Minister Theresa May. It said a shadowy intelligence cabal conspired to replace May with Boris Johnson to secure a hard Brexit deal with the EU. Saudi Arabia faces criticism after its Supreme Court upheld death sentences against two young Bahraini nationals over false terror charges. Several Bahraini opposition groups have called the ruling unfair and arbitrary. They say the ruling was issued based on confessions extracted under torture. The groups have called on the international community to prevent Saudi authorities from carrying out the sentences. Human rights organizations and social media activists have reacted too, calling for the immediate release of the two Bahraini nationals. Sadiq Majid Thamer and Jafar Mohammed Sultan were arrested in May 2015. Saudi Arabia accused them of smuggling explosives into the kingdom and involvement in terrorist activities. Let me bring in Sandus al-Assad. He is a Bahraini political activist joining us from Beirut. Thank you so much for joining us. So why should Saudi Arabia target two Bahraini nationals and hand them the death penalty? What are the likely objectives here?
Unfortunately, the two Bahraini nationals are being purchased for political reasons. Those two young men have been tortured, have been ill-treated, and have been subjected to an enforced disappearance for likely more than 100 days without accessing legal help. So those two defendants have been persecuted for political reasons and have been tortured, as I have mentioned, for their peaceful activism. And Saudi Arabia unfortunately follows the same method of Bahrain, which is persecuting political activists for no reason. The only reason, if they have committed something which is calling for freedom, calling for basic human rights.
Right. The Bahraini people's uprising against the ruling establishment roared into life more than a decade ago and is still alive. Can you walk us through the status quo, tell us how far this movement has come and if any of its objectives have been achieved up to this point?
Unfortunately, nothing has been achieved because of the strict measures taken by the government, backed by the Saudi regime and backed by foreign Western government like the UK and the US. The Bahraini authorities haven't responded for these demands, these basic demands of an elected government, a just judiciary, a constitution which treats all the Bahrainis equally. In its last report, Al-Wifaq for the UN Human Rights Council, it has raised the issue of how the Bahraini government violates the political and civil rights of the people, despite pledging that it will go through rights reforms. But unfortunately, those are just slogans. Nothing is practiced on ground, and this status quo currently is quite dangerous, especially taking in regard the issue of normalization. And today the Mossad is present in Bahrain, and so the human rights violations are expected to escalate. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the government doesn't respect its pledges to the UN, to its own report, to its own committee, the BICI, the Bisuni committee. Unfortunately, the government of Bahrain preaches on democracy, preaches on human rights, but when it comes to the practical matter, we see nothing but more violations, more infringements of the right. Political rights. Now the top opposition leader, Sheikh Khalid Salman and others, are still behind bars, merely because they have practiced their political rights, their fundamental rights, and nothing is changing in Bahrain.
Thank you so much.
The people are being further persecuted by the government.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your time. That was Sandus al-Assad. She's a Bahraini political activist joining us from Beirut. Syria says its air defenses have intercepted Israeli missiles during a fresh attack near the capital, Damascus. Syria's defense ministry says the strikes left three people dead and led to some material damage. Earlier, Syrian media reported that air defenses confronted quote-unquote hostile targets in the sky in the Damascus countryside. The report said the Israeli attack also caused a fire near Damascus International Airport, delaying a number of flights. Israel earlier launched a volley of missiles on Syria on May the 14th, killing five Syrian soldiers. Mohammed Ali, our correspondent in Damascus, tells us more about the repeated acts of Israeli aggression against Syria.
According to an official military source, at about 11 p.m. local time in Damascus, Israel carried out a missile attack, a surface-to-surface missile attack, which was launched from the occupied Syrian Golan and hit targets in areas in the southern countryside of Damascus. Right away, Syria's air defenses, as usual, intercepted the attack, shooting down most of the enemy missiles. However, it seems that some of them did hit their targets, because three persons were killed as a result of this attack. Now, definitely, this is not the first kind of attack, especially this year, or at least this month, in which Israel stepped up its attacks, whether in central Syria, in areas like Musyaf and Hama, or around the Syrian capital, Damascus, or in the south, around Al-Quneitra. Syria always sends letters to the United Nations Security Council and Secretary General with regards to such attacks. But so far, despite the tens of letters, there are still international silence about this. Still, there is no action being taken as an independent country is being attacked, a sovereign country is being attacked.
Moving on, Israeli forces shoot dead a Palestinian teenager during a raid on Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Health Ministry says troopers also opened fire on an 18-year-old, leaving him in critical condition. The incident comes days after the Israeli military killed Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh while she was covering a regime raid on the refugee camp. In recent months, Jenin has been at the center of tensions in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli regime has recently escalated its atrocities against Palestinians in the occupied territories. More than 20 Palestinians have been killed at the hands of Israeli forces since the end of March. And with that, we'll come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Agent Orange, a chemical cocktail that became notorious as a defoliant, was used in aerial bombardments against the Viet Cong in the Vietnam War. The U.S. military sprayed millions of gallons of Agent Orange onto Vietnam's jungles during the conflict to expose northern communist troops. 40 years since the end of the war, people in Vietnam with severe mental and physical disabilities still feel the lingering effects of Agent Orange. Its legacy of death and deformity is well documented. Cancer and birth defects amongst both Vietnamese and U.S. veterans have been linked to exposure to the defoliant. But what is less known is how Agent Orange was used after the war. I'm Zarin Shajari, and this is Aperture. Agent Orange is made up of the chemicals 245T and 24D. In the 1960s and 70s in Australia, the solution used in weed eradication often involved the spraying of herbicides 245T and 24D with terrifying consequences. Sprayers were often exposed to the deadly poison without any protective gear. Many sprayers died young, one after another. But still, this is not the full extent of the problems caused by the chemicals. Stay with us as we meet the families of former government employees who have died almost certainly as a result of their exposure.
...31-year-old Nigel Sinclair is in the last stage of terminal cancer. Nigel and his family believe he's soon to be the latest legacy from a chemical exposure which they say has killed his father, his uncle and many of their mates. Before Nigel dies, he wants to know how a tragedy like this could happen.
At this very late stage, what would be the very best outcome for you?
It was like answers, really, just so my nana can rest and I can rest and me and my family can rest and put it to rest.
I'm lucky that he's still with us and still going. He has his moment where he'd like to have his closure.
Back in the 1970s and 1980s, hundreds of men were employed by the various state governments around the country to spray noxious weeds. Today, many are sick and many are dead.
A lot of the boys end up being the same, fading away near enough to nothing. Doctors turn and just, feed your medication, kill the pain. You're right, you'll be right. And next thing you know, they're dead.
Nigel's father was one of about 320 men in the West Australian Kimberley who sprayed herbicides for the state's Agriculture Protection Board, or APB. Now, there are reports of the sprayer's partners and children getting sick.
I think that they should have a close look, epidemiologically and clinically, at the children of those APB workers. I think that they should suspect that they'll have huge problems to deal with.
Mr. Hunter, Nigel's father, was one of many Indigenous men who joined the government spraying teams.
They should work from sun up to sundown for what pay they got, little knowing that they're going to die later on in later years.
What the men didn't know was the herbicides they were spraying from backpacks were the same chemicals used to make Agent Orange in the Vietnam War, 245T and 24D, which were contaminated with dangerous dioxins.
Poison was carried on the same vehicle as their water drums, and their swags and everything used to get soaked with the poison. They slept in it, worked in it for 10 days at a time. And all their clothes will get washed at home.
it wasn't an accidental spill on any workday. Their bodies were exposed to the herbicide all day, and I'm not talking about 8 hours in the day, but 24 hours a day, every week, for months and years. I can't conceive of anywhere where the exposure has been so intense and at such a level and for so long.
One of the workers, Carl Drysdale, said they would cart the drums of chemicals in the back of a four-wheel drive. The sprayers would go into the bush for 10 days at a time. For the first few years, the men were given no protective clothing.
Most of the people would be wearing what was appropriate for the heat, which would be shorts and thongs and T-shirts, you know.
A few years after spraying the chemicals, many of the men began to get sick.
Now, in the beginning, what were you told about the chemicals? How safe were they?
Harmless. So harmless you could drink it.
That's what they told you?
That's right.
Who told you that?
Oh, all the bosses, all the head shrinks.
But Carl Drysdale, who was the foreman, felt responsible for his men, and he was getting worried.
They all got rashes, everybody got rashes, headaches, and I guess internal bleeding was another pretty universal thing, like they were vomiting blood and passing blood.
Carl wrote to his superiors in June 1982 about his concerns. A manager from the West Australian Agriculture Protection Board wrote back saying that 245T was not considered dangerous if used as recommended, and that he did not support staff undertaking their own research.
You're told that the stuff's harmless, so you think, well, you know, I'm probably wrong, so you give them the benefit of the doubt, you know? And that was a mistake to trust the government, you know?
The job was a perfect job for them, and they loved that kind of environment. Maybe if it had been a white person, they most probably would have stood up and said, well, I'm not spraying this, this doesn't smell nice, I'm getting a rash, I'm getting sores, I'm not touching this anymore. Well, they wouldn't, they didn't want to lose their job.
After years of spraying, Mr. Hunter became so ill that he could no longer work and was often bedridden. He had sores all over his body, respiratory problems, dramatic weight loss, and extreme fatigue.
His black arms were dyed white or bleached white where that poison came in contact. He had great big lumps under his jaw from his glands, under his arms, and he told me in his groin. His general health was so bad that he couldn't get up the stairs at work to get his pay.
At 33, Mr. Hunter died in his sleep. He was the first of the Kimberley men to die, but others soon followed.
How many of those men are still alive?
Not very many, and if any, they're sick today.
Mainly headaches, but at the moment, yeah.
For more than 30 years, Carl Drysdale has been fighting to get workers' compensation for the surviving men.
Kept me awake all night last night.
When are you going to see the doctor?
I told the doctor.
Carl himself has not been able to work since 1985 because of a range of illnesses he believes were linked to the spraying. His wife Marion has had to support him and their four children.
Carl has suffered from just about everything you can suffer from, and I've seen the physical decline in this powerful, energetic man since he finished with the APB.
I had, like, constant heart attacks, unconscious. They told my wife I was going to die over and over again. 5 black spots on my lungs. I've used cortisone cream for rashes that's ruined my bones.
OK. And you just hold it level with your heart there. Okay.
Dr. Randolph Spargo was a local GP and saw many of the sprayers, including Carl Drysdale.
So it's definitely abnormal, Carl, but much better than it used to be.
Have you got any doubt all these years later that it was the chemicals that made a lot of these men sick and in some cases killed them?
No doubt about it. I wouldn't go near that herbicide.
The herbicides were contaminated with dangerous dioxins. Chemical Industries Kwinana in Perth imported some of these chemicals, which were supplied to the West Australian Agriculture Protection Board.
According to their normal toxicity...
In 1978, Four Corners reporter Andrew Olley interviewed the owner, the late Robert Telford.
But it's not a commercial problem.
What do you mean it's not a commercial problem?
It's because it's not possible for a person using commercial 245T containing these minute infinitesimal quantities of dioxin to be poisoned by them.
How do you know that?
The toxicity becomes meaningless in the dilution.
A few years later, Professor Ben Salinger, a former head of chemistry at the Australian National University, traced some of the chemicals to Singapore, where one batch had been fire damaged.
The normal herbicide would have been light in colour and fairly fluid. The sample we had from the tariff board was clunky and black, so it would appear that there was a good chance they were using the stuff that we also looked at.
All of a sudden, at least 30, 44 gallon drums of concentrate arrived, and it was completely different to the stuff in the 20 litre drums. The stuff in the 20 litre drums was like engine oil and or honey, you know, colour. And the next lot came, it was black and thick, and it blocked up all the nozzles. And 30 drums was enough for at least 20 years.
Tests on a sample of the fire-damaged chemical later revealed it had 200 times the allowable level of dioxin then, and more than 2,000 times the levels permitted in later years.
Well, I think it would have been very dangerous. It was much higher than what was used in Vietnam. And at those levels, I think they were really exposed to a high level of risk.
The men continued to die.
They die with that sort of lingering question mark hanging over, why has this happened to me, you know? And to see that is terrible.
In 2001, occupational work specialist Dr. Andrew Harper was asked to investigate if the men's illnesses were linked to chemical exposure. Dr. Harper says the government's Agriculture Protection Board repeatedly failed in its duty of care.
One, they were not trained. Two, there wasn't an induction program. The information about the risk was not given to them. The supervision was not there. And they were not given, in the main, safety equipment. So they simply went out in shorts and shirts and thongs, and that was it. And there wasn't any systematic washing after exposure. So they were just completely exposed. And the authorities didn't take a responsible stand to, in fact, correct the situation.
Dr. Harper recommended all those who were sick be considered for compensation.
I recommended that compensation be considered, as I felt there had been a disservice done to all these people. And it wasn't only manifest in a specific illness, which was difficult to define. It was manifest through the way they were treated and through the impact that that had on their lives and on their feelings of alienation.
But the West Australian Labor government responded to Dr. Harper's recommendation by calling for another report.
Asking for a scientific study created a distraction from the content of my report.
That the men be compensated.
That the men be compensated. It diverted attention away from all of the injustices of the whole program. It diverted attention away from the suffering that these people had, and it diverted attention away from the moral issues that the whole thing exemplifies.
Former Agricultural Minister Kim Chance commissioned the new report.
Harper's report took us a long way because we began from a situation where we were trying to uncover the results of an event that occurred 20 years before. Harper's report allowed us to tie those events together. He said, look, it looks like there's a cause and effect issue here.
He was a lot stronger than that. He recommended that you consider compensation for all those men.
Yes.
He found a failure of duty of care by various governments.
Yes.
He found that there was no protective clothing, that these chemicals were suspected of being incredibly toxic and no training. Why did you need statistics to compensate the men when you had all that before you?
Because our means of compensation is the WorkSafe principles or the WorkCover principles. That's the only means we have of compensating a former government worker.
I'd like to get a jar of that poison and pour it down some of those politicians' mouth. Let them see how they feel about it.
The new report recommended only men with cancer be eligible for compensation. 10 years later, only 8 men have received workers' compensation.
To effect what Dr. Harper wanted us to do required a change in the law.
Well, why didn't you change the law?
Well, that's a matter for the whole of government to deal with. That's way beyond the authority of the Minister for Agriculture.
Dr. Randolph Spargo said the men were actually poisoned.
Yes, they were. They were. And they were told that the chemical that they were using couldn't possibly hurt them.
In fact, they were told it was so safe they could drink it.
They could drink it.
I mean, given all that, do you now, all these years later, find it hard to reconcile that they were never compensated, the great bulk of those men who got sick?
Yes.
If you could...
I'll go further than that. I think Dr. Harper's recommendation was the right recommendation.
You're getting a rash on there too. There's all red on that side.
Despite this admission, nothing is likely to change for the children and partners of the sprayers, who believe they are now affected.
Slowly.
3 years ago, Nigel Sinclair was diagnosed with leiomyosarcoma, which is growing on a muscle at the back of his liver. Studies have linked soft tissue sarcoma with toxic exposure from Agent Orange, which was equal parts 245T and 24D.
Just battling to get up and walk around now. Just finding it hard to get out of bed and that, and had to get a new bed now, so... Yeah, and I'm more confined to a wheelchair. You can put my shirt down now.
No mother wants to watch their son deteriorate like this, and it's something that can't fix, you know? Can't kiss it better, can't put a Band-Aid on it, and I just got to watch him. And I don't like to. Got to try and keep strong.
More than 3 decades ago, when Sue Sinclair was pregnant with Nigel, she used to wash his father's chemical-drenched clothes. After Nigel was born, she would put his nappies in the wash with his father's work gear. And Nigel would crawl all over his father and his swag.
Horrible to think that I might have passed something on to my son. Now, I'd take that away from him any day and put it on myself.
If dioxin was present, the residual level of dioxin in the clothes need not be very high to be potentially harmful. And these chemicals have got the potential to damage genes and produce an adverse effect in the next generation. And this is a real concern.
Of the 77 workers Dr. Harper interviewed, 58% reported having fertility problems, stillbirths and premature births. There were 12 reports of birth defects.
Some of the blokes have described what their children look like, and I won't even say what they've said about their own children, what they look like. And
why? What was
they look
wrong?
Like monsters, you know, like because of the deformities that they had.
Back in 1976, on the other side of the country, in the small rural town of Yarram in Victoria's Gippsland, a cluster of birth defects was found by a local GP. Dr. Rod Guy told Four Corners he believed the deformities might be linked to heavy spraying of 245T and 24D.
Well, we made a list of the abnormalities, the problems we'd had.
I'd had some really awful things happen, which were really unusual. A baby born without a brain, a baby born without kidneys. Now, in general practice, it's unusual to have serious birth defects.
The Victorian government held an inquiry in 1978.
The disappointing thing was that I thought that the inquiry was really very superficial, and I think to be honest, rushed to get a political answer.
The inquiry dismissed concerns that the chemicals were potentially dangerous and found that the cluster of birth defects in Yarram could have happened by chance. 2 years later, Professors Ben Salinger and Peter Hall found that there were serious statistical errors with that finding.
Well, Peter Hall is probably one of Australia's best statisticians, and he did that work and showed that the way they did their comparisons would have minimised anything showing up. And when he redid the work using their data, he showed a very high and strong correlation.
So in other words, they were saying that there wasn't a disproportionate number of birth abnormalities.
That's right, yeah. And his results showed that there were a very high proportion of birth abnormalities.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You're welcome to For a Better Life with me, Javed Akbari. Well, in this episode, we are going to talk about the ultimate goal. We know very well that we are from Allah and to Him we return. Our origin is Allah. We have understood our origin, our present and our future. What is important for us is the ultimate goal, because we have goals in our life. There are goals that we have for our material life. These are not ultimate goals, of course. The ultimate goal is the goal which guarantees our happiness, or which has something to do with our happiness. There are a few points to be remembered in connection with the ultimate goal. First of all, we are created by Allah, the wise, and we are not created through chance or without any purpose. So our life is purposeful. This is number one. And the point two, or number two, is that our Creator is absolutely needless. So whatever is considered by Him as the goal of our creation is completely to our benefit. Because God Himself is self-sufficient. He is Hamid and He is needless. So we should try our best to actualize, to materialize whatever He wants for us. There's no doubt that our creation is purposeful. Whatever is considered by Him as the goal of our creation is in our best interest. And then the third point that I would like to raise and discuss with you is that this universe is perishable. This universe is fleeting. And this universe is transient. In other words, this world is mortal. It's not as precious as ourselves. You know, we can live forever since our spirits are not material and mortal. The flesh that we have is mortal, but the spirit that we have is not material. وَلِلْرُوحْ مِنْ أَمْرِ رَبِّي. Ruh, the spirit that we have in our chest, of course, is from Allah. And we don't know what actually spirit is, but it is something that comes from Allah. We should search to find our goal in something other than this material life. We must avoid becoming engaged in a circular life. There is another point that I would like to mention, and that is an endless future is awaiting us. The pleasure, the pains, and the hereafter are not comparable with those of this universe. Complete happiness can be experienced only in paradise. There is no doubt about it. And of course, this world cannot be compared with the other world. The happiness, the pleasure, and the pains and sufferings are, of course, in the hereafter, are totally different from those of this world. And so our future completely depends on our present, depending on how our present situation is, whether we are happy in this world. It has a direct impact on our living condition in the afterworld. Let's have a break. We will be back.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes. And we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
The spiritual realm and the material realms are interconnected with each other. They are intertwined. Depending on what we do for our happiness in this world, we will either be happy in the afterworld or we will be sad. It depends on what we actually do, whether we make efforts to materialize our goals in this world, to achieve our spiritual goals and our ultimate goal. That's the goal that we should work for. That's the goal that we should make efforts for. Brothers and sisters, in Islam, every value is dependent on the relationship with Allah. You know, there's no value measured apart from Allah. Our happiness is based on our voluntary devotion to Allah. Our happiness is based on our voluntary worship of Allah. If we are close to Allah, nothing can threaten us. Nothing can, you know, undermine our happiness. Dear brothers and sisters, our happiness, our felicity, our salvation, and the ultimate goal that we should endeavor to achieve rests in achieving closeness to Allah. So closeness to Allah is the ultimate goal. It is the ultimate purpose. I will now concentrate on the concept of closeness to Allah and its consequences. Of course, those who are close to Allah, their life and their situation differs from those who are not close to Allah. So closeness to Allah is the most important asset. It's the most important goal that a person should achieve. It's the ultimate goal. It's through closeness that happiness is achieved. It's through closeness to Allah that, you know, even material blessing can be achieved. It is through closeness to Allah that perfection is achieved. And of course, these concepts are interrelated. They are interconnected to each other. There is no doubt that Allah is absolutely needless. He is the wise. He creates purposefully. And of course, in the Holy Quran, it is mentioned emphatically that creation is not purposeless. The world, the humanity, and everything in this world has been created with a purpose. And this purpose has to be achieved.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
God says in chapter 23, verse 115, أَفَحَسِبْتُمْ أَنَّمَا خَلَقْنَاكُمْ. Do you think we have created you in vain? وَأَنَّكُمْ إِلَيْنَا لَا تُرْجَعُونَ. And you shall not be returned to us. Is this what you think? So, by this verse, Allah the Almighty wants to tell us that we have not been created in vain. We have been created for a purpose. The benefit of creation is for the creatures, not for the creator. Because the creator is needless. Allah is able to create the opportunity for his creature to reach perfection. He knows what is in our best interest. He is the final and the efficient cause. The final and the efficient cause are the same. So, brothers and sisters, as I said, we have middle goals. We have, you know, goals that are temporary. We have goals that are, you know, achieved in this world. Those are not the ultimate goals. Those are not the main goals that for which we have been created. Allah has created us for a very important goal, which is called the ultimate goal. Allah the Almighty has provided us the means through which we can achieve those goals. هُوَ الَّذِي خَلَقَ لَكُمْ مَا فِي الْأَرْضِ جَمِيعًا. He is the one who created for you all that is in the earth. وَسَخَّرَ لَكُمْ مَا فِي السَّمَاوَاتِ وَمَا فِي الْأَرْضِ جَمِيعًا مِنْهُ. And Allah has made subservient to you whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth. All from Himself. Allah has provided us the opportunity, the means through which we can achieve our goals. وَالسَّلَامُ عَلَيْكُمْ وَرَحْمَةُ اللَّهِ وَبَرَكَاتُهُ.
Every grain of sand in every desert land He knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand He knows. tear on every eyelash.
He knows
every thought I have
and every word I share.
He knows,
Allah knows.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.